Okay, great. Well, this is the eighth of this 10-call cycle. We do these informal calls in cycles of 10. And this cycle, we've been focusing primarily on that first year, all the problems that people have in establishing their program for that first year after they get the grant. We talked to Detroit and Flint, Michigan, Lewis and Clark, talked about their positives and negatives, the issues of trying to establish a reputation in the town, trying to develop employer relationships, certainly getting the trust of the people in the community and recruiting people. But today we decided to shift gears a little bit. Someone just joined?
It's Bruce.
Hey, Bruce. Today we're shifting gears a little bit, and it was prompted by a Department of Labor webinar that was last week that talked about women in trades. That's called WANTO, Women Apprenticeships in Non-Traditional Occupations. I thought it'd be really nice to have Amy on today from Oregon Tradeswomen. Someone just joined?
Yeah, my name's April, and I'm working for OTI, Oregon
okay.
Tradeswomen.
Hey, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
Good. Well, we'll just continue. And so we thought it would be really great to have Amy on. Now, Amy is not actively funded, but they're up for a re-up, and we're certainly hoping that they'll get a re-up. And it doesn't – many of our grantees have had programs. In fact, Oregon Tradeswomen had one in, way back in 2004, and then they kind of went into hibernation, and then you got another one in 2007, another grant in 2009, and then another in 2012, well-deserved. And these are all very competitive grants that they were recompeted for and achieved. So before we talk to Amy, though, we're going to do what we always do, is talk about news from Washington, what's happening, and a little bit about grant opportunities. And Glo, do you want to give us an update on what you've heard?
Sure. Yeah, I talked to Joe, in fact, on Monday this week. He wanted me to remind everybody about the National Brownfields Conference in Chicago on September 2nd through the 4th. If you have not registered for that yet, I would strongly encourage you to do so. I did get a marketing brochure from headquarters yesterday, so I'm going to be posting that to the listserv. They have a little bit more information about the plenary sessions and some of the training sessions, as in the topics that's going to be going, and they also have the conference schedule at a glance. So stay tuned for that. I'll try to get it out this afternoon. And kind of going along with that, EPA has hired a contractor by the name of Angela Conroy, who is putting together a publication that highlights success stories under the expanded EWDJT program. They're going to release this publication at the National Brownfields Conference in Chicago. So if you have a success story that you would like to have included in this publication, I would encourage you to call Angela. Her phone number is 540-243-1188, and again, her name is Angela Conroy. Mike, you want to put that in the post-meeting
yes.
notes?
Okay.
Or call Joe Bruss at headquarters, and his phone number is 202-566-2772. Then I also wanted to talk a little bit about the mid-year grantee update webinar that we're going to be having on April 20th from 1 to 2 p.m. Central Daylight Time. I posted this on the listserv first on March 2nd, and I'll put more reminders out there along with a link to join. You don't need to register to join in on this webinar. This is the result of grantee feedback. Grantees told us that they wanted to have an update about midway through between the face-to-face all grantee meetings. So during this webinar, we're actually going to have three EPA people, two from headquarters and one from Region 4, and three grantees speaking on different topics. The grantees are going to be talking on placement issues from a different perspective. So we have a big city perspective, a mid-sized city perspective, and a rural perspective, all on placement issues. So again, that's on April 20th from 1 to 2 p.m. Central Daylight Time. And then also on the listserv, we just released the invitation for the annual face-to-face all grantee meeting that will be held on August 19th and 20th at the Holiday Inn and Suites Alexandria Historic District in Alexandria, Virginia. We've actually received several registrations already, so that's great. The registration deadline for that is July 29th. It's open to all current and past grantees and active PLC members. So the sooner you register, the better you will be. We do have a reserved block of rooms at the Holiday Inn. And through our cooperative agreement with the EPA, we can pay for three nights of lodging for people who come in from out of town. So Michael, put that in the meeting notes too. But if you have any questions, give me a call or an email about that. And let's see, the new grantee announcement is still anticipated to take place in May. The new grantees will be notified by mail. And then there was the never-ending reminder of don't forget to report your numbers in acres. That is so, so important. So keep doing that. And then one last update from HMTRI. We are in the process of updating our Brownfields Toolbox website. We have a new logo, and it's looking pretty cool. So check that out, but be patient. There are some of the tabs that don't have information in it yet, but we're getting there. So that's all I have, Mike.
Lots of news. We'll put all of these in the notes. We'll include all of that information. So if you didn't get to jot it down, we'll include that, including the Green Jobs Conference in April 13th. And then, of course, our all grantee meeting is just to us so important, where we get all the grantees and we get all the regional reps and all the headquarters people and assistant administrator and Joe, and everyone's there. So it's a great conference. And of course, the National Brownfields Conference in Chicago, which will be with everyone else. And we'll have a booth at that conference. And when we get closer, we'll encourage people to bring materials and brochures so they could use our booth as a kind of little headquarters for them. Also in these post-session notes, I'm going to include some grant opportunities. There was one that came out this week that was very interesting, a Department of Labor. The training to work, it's oriented towards ex-offenders, and a lot of our programs have ex-offenders, deal with ex-offenders, and it's a $27 million training to work program. They're going to award 20 grants of $1.36 million each, and it has to do with everything that our grantees do, basically high poverty, high crime rates, providing training in industry-recognized credentials, doing follow-up, everything that the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program does, this program is asking to do. So when you see that in the post-session notes, you might cruise over to grants.gov and see if it's something that you might be able to dovetail off your Environmental Workforce Program into this Department of Labor program. As I said, all these things will be in the post-session notes, which you'll get in a couple of days. If you're not getting post-session notes, just drop me your contact information, and it's msenyu@aol.com. So it's M as in Michael, S as in Sam, E-N as in Nancy, E-W, at aol.com. We put out notices for the PLCs both on our big listserv, and then we have our smaller PLC list, which gets not only the announcements but the post-session notes. And if you're not getting those, then and you want to get them, just send that out. We have about 250 people on that PLC list, and the listserv is even larger than that. So having said all of these announcements, we want to turn this over to Amy. And Amy's got such a great program, and it's solely oriented towards bringing women into the trades. Now, we have other grantees that do have women in their program, but Oregon Tradeswomen has specifically addressed the issues of women, and they're not only members of the WANTO consortia, that is, and Amy was suggesting that they're going to be developing curriculum for other programs. There are other women's programs around. There's Tradeswomen Inc., there's Chicago Women in Trades, but Amy's program is our program that involves environmental training coupled with the women in non-traditional trades, which includes the construction trades. But it's very interesting the way she does her recruitment and then channels some of their best students into the environmental program. So with that, Amy, can you give us a rundown of your program?
I sure can. Thanks so much. My name is Amy. My last name is James Neal, two words. And I'm the construction manager and job developer here at Oregon Tradeswomen in Portland, Oregon. So I am just going to blast through my program really, really quickly and get to the interesting part, which is questions and discussion. So bear with me as I blow through. I am a carpenter by trade. I worked in the trade for 20-plus years before closing my all-female construction company and beginning teaching here at Oregon Tradeswomen full-time somewhere around 8 years ago or so. So Oregon Tradeswomen, we've been around since, 1989. We are dedicated to promoting success for women in the trades through education, leadership, and mentorship. And we are here to help women and minorities be successful in construction trades. And I say construction trades, but that very much includes the work that our environmental techs do, so that I'm interchanging using the word trades or construction trades with it because, you know, our people that do our laborers, our heavy equipment operators, our asbestos removal, recycling, all of those jobs I consider non-traditional for women and trades jobs. So also our program very much about racial justice as well as gender justice. Our program, the adult program, the one that I think is most relevant to talk about here with this group, we serve about 100 women per year. It varies a little bit depending on funding, but approximately 100 women per year. So Oregon Tradeswomen, we offer a number of different programs. We have a girls program where we're inside the middle schools and the high schools exposing girls to the opportunities in the trades. We have a tradeswomen advocacy group that develops leadership in tradeswomen and advocates for equality on jobs and in contracts. If any of you happen to be in the area of Portland, Oregon, around May 14th, 15th, and 16th, we have an enormous Women in Trades career fair, where we have a day of middle school girls, a day of high school girls, and then a day open to the general public where all women can come out and be exposed to all of the trades here in Portland. So all of the training programs come out, and they bring the tools of the trades, and girls and women can meet female role models doing this work and try their hand at the equipment. So we have, you know, little tiny girls climbing power poles, and they performing a broken water main repair, and there's a workshop where you actually build a house. It's all, you know, you do the foundation, you put up the walls, the girls operate a crane, jackhammer, they're running around the property on excavators, they get to weld and solder, they get to be tied off and climb iron beams with iron workers, they insulate a home for home performance, they wire a light and a switch with the electricians, build concrete forms. Basically, they get exposed to all these trades that they may not otherwise know about. Part of it that's really fun for me is there's a tradeswoman fashion show where all of the tradeswomen come out in their work gear and their tools, and they parade around, and the girls get to learn about what a tradeswoman looks like. But the most relevant program that we have here at Oregon Tradeswomen for this group is our trades and apprenticeship career class with the environmental track. So this program it's free to our participants. It's 7 weeks long, and it is to prepare women for careers in the construction trades with a special focus on environmental jobs. So our students are in class 3 days a week. One day they're in the classroom, and they are learning construction math, measurement, industry pace and expectations. They learn what apprenticeship is. A lot of women don't even know what apprenticeship is. We learn about communication skills on the job site, which, since it's a very male-dominated culture, they're not male jobs, but it's a very male-dominated. We teach women how to sort of navigate that with their construction skills and their communication skills. We talk about preparing for the workday. We talk about building allies and dealing with discrimination. Lots of focus on the measuring tape. We develop a trades resume as part of our class, and we practice interviewing for trades positions, which is, again, really different than some of the jobs that women typically apply for. So that's day one. Day two, they are out on industry field trips. So we take our students to many of the local training centers or construction sites, depending on what's available, and, again, expose them to the many trades opportunities. So this gives them a chance to see the industry firsthand and sort of picture themselves doing that work. And all of these are led by tradeswomen in the field. So when we go to the roofers, we meet female roofers. When we go to the sheet metal, same deal. Carpenters, the laborers, heavy equipment operators, we go to all of these training centers so our students can get sort of a feel for what best resonates with them. So that's day two. Day three, they are out in the field with me. So it's a hands-on work day. So we partner with nonprofits that need carpentry-based construction work done, and we perform that work for free as a way to offer our students construction experience. So the students on day three, they strap on the tool belt and they build under the supervision of our female contractors. So on this day, it's very much run like a professional construction job site. There's a strong emphasis on work, pace, on attitude, on for women especially, that assertive learning. So advocating for your skills, not letting somebody put you behind a broom and have you sweep up all day, but saying, hey, I'll sweep up and then I need to learn how to use that chop saw. So we sort of teach them those assertive learning skills. And, of course, a lot of emphasis on safe use of power tools. I think a successful part of our program is that our students are given a written evaluation from their instructor at the end of each workday, which gives them feedback about their performance. And these are women from the industry, so this is the industry talking to the students. And we tell them that accepting this feedback is either going to dictate them being successful in the trades or having a really rough time. So if you can't accept that feedback with a positive attitude and with the expectation that this is a way to grow and learn, which of course translates into more money, then this is a skill that we work on. During our 7-week program, they are also in fitness training 2 times a week, getting them, again, ready for that industry expectation. Super strong emphasis on attendance in our class. So if they miss more than one day or late more than 2 times, they are asked to come back to the program when they're ready to meet that industry expectation. They leave our program with their OSHA 10 card. And if they meet all of the expectations in our program, that is showing up on time, having a good attitude, getting good evaluations, that reliability factor is met, then they are invited to attend our ongoing environmental worker track. So this is for our students who are specifically interested in those environmental tech jobs. So we have continued training for them. We happen to have in Portland here a super fun site in our backyard known as the Portland Harbor. It's heavily polluted. There's going to be a lot of upcoming jobs cleaning this mess up. So that's a big part of our focus on our training. So we take the students out to the Portland Harbor with one of our partners and also one of our partner employers. They perform cleanup on the river, and we do a tour of the river, and we talk about the industry, how it got there, what we're going to do to clean it up, and how their training is going to translate into their ability to work on this river in their own community. There's additional classroom training about the career options in environmental remediation. We talk about the many different placements that we've had for our past students, and they actually sit with a panel of our partner employers, and we call it speed mentoring. So there's an employer at each table, and the students cycle around each table, and they get to talk to the employer, talk about what they do, and again, this is a way to expose them to the job opportunities. So we usually have women from weatherization, we have heavy equipment operators, laborers, asbestos abatement, recycling, deconstruction, soil testing. There's usually somebody from the city of Portland there, the people who build the bioswales, and the students get to learn about these job opportunities. They get really excited about it. They really connect with these women that are already doing the work. Placement, our placement rate hovers around 80%. Last year, 82%. Year before, 79%. We usually lose about, we serve 24 to 25 students per class, and we usually lose about 1 or 2 students per class. And this is fine with us, because if they're not industry ready, we really don't want to tarnish our reputation in the community by sending people out that aren't ready. So we're fine with people dropping out if they're not ready for the work or if it doesn't resonate with them. We're good with that. Super strong job placement support after class. So after they have met our expectations, we go to work for them. So we connect them with our partner employers. We help them find jobs. We connect them with alumni that have already graduated and sort of plug them into the trades community. We have this monthly social hour for alumni and students and tradeswomen and employers, and it's very well attended, and it's a great opportunity to network, and We usually have some sort of theme every year, or every month, and this year's was a gear swap. So everybody brought their gear, and they swapped gear and tools, and it was really fun. So when I attend the conference every fall, the thing that I most frequently ask is, how the heck do you find women that want to do this work? Which is, of course, mystifying to me because we have a wait list for our class every time. We actually see three times more women than we're able to serve. So there's an enormous demand for our program. And the thing that I typically ask the people are, well, what are you doing to reach out to women? What does your marketing material look like? And it almost always is a group of men. And it just says, hey, come get our training. But women don't respond well to that. Much like if there was a poster of a bunch of women on it, men probably wouldn't feel terribly invited to join that training. So women need to see other women doing the work. You know, if you can't see it, you can't be it is kind of a thing that we say. So have female trainers, have women on your posters. Women need to feel like they're being addressed specifically. They need to know that they'll be taught how to do it because women tend to have sort of a doubt that their knowledge is expandable, that they're going to be taught. And there's this sort of illusion of choice, like, oh, you can be whatever you want to be when you grow up. But if you go down the girls' toy aisle and the boys' toy aisle, you know that that's not true. Girls are trained that this is not their job. And if you have a poster of showing nothing but men on it, there's this sort of not-so-subtle message that these are men's jobs and that the training is only offered to men. So that's a good place to start. And having women trainers is great. Having women on your outreach committee, whoever does the outreach at your events, that really helps too. And, you know, the office workers don't count. That just sort of reinforces to your potential students that women belong in the office and that men belong in the field. So having female trainers really, really helps as well. I'm not sure what else to say. I would love to answer any questions that you might have about our program or recruiting women in general.
Amy, one of the neat thing about your program is you're so focused on women and you've got the curriculum and everything's oriented towards women. Now, what happens to programs maybe like Arts or ArtShanks or perhaps somewhere in the southeast where we may be somewhat more male-dominated, but we have women in the program?
Yes. So across the nation, there are only about 2.9% women in non-traditional employment, so in this case, the construction trades. So that doesn't vary anywhere in the nation. It's a very male-dominated field. However, in Oregon here at Oregon Tradeswomen, since we specifically do outreach to women and we've refined our outreach process to women and we've let women in our community know that these jobs are available, they pay living wage, they pay, you know, typically three times the minimum wage, they are excited about it. And when they're reached out to specifically, they want this work. So women want this work for the exact same reason that men want this work. It's a good wage. It's satisfying work, cleaning up your community, you know, removing the toxins out of your community. In many cases, there's retirement. So this appeals to women. This work appeals to women. They are good at this work. They just simply need to be – it needs to be a – they need to know that it's available to them. And there's nothing in our culture that lets women know that construction work in any realm is open to them. So I know that Art does a good job of reaching out to women. I know he also has mentors, past women who have gone on to be successful, that he occasionally draws on to reach out to women at outreach events or to mentor his current female students. And I think he has a really good sense that you have to train women. So you can't let them into your program and sort of marginalize them. They need to be, you have to have the same expectations. You have to have a zero tolerance policy for harassment in any realm, and that means unprofessional behavior. That means unprofessional behavior on everybody's part. There's no dating. There's no flirting. That's unprofessional behavior. And train these women how to be trades workers, just like you would the men. So it's as soon as you start doing outreach specifically geared toward diverse men and women, they will come into your program. You just have to be ready to train them. And the program has to accommodate the different barriers that these different groups of people experience.
So,
and if you have any question around how to do that, I am always available for advice. I can send you paperwork. I can walk you through a training program. Oregon Tradeswomen is very motivated to help other programs successfully reach out to and train and keep women in their programs.
Once you get them into the classroom, then you're gender blind. Is that it? I mean, totally gender blind?
No, I would say no to that. I would say you can't be gender blind because women's experience is different than men's. So you actually have to have some awareness of that. For instance, I would say culturally, like for instance, if you're practicing interviewing in class, men are culturally trained to sort of brag about their accomplishments, which works really, really well in job interview. And women are told that they cannot brag and they should not be bold and they should not talk about themselves, and they tend to minimize their accomplishments, which does not serve them well in a trades interview. So I think being gender blind doesn't serve women in that it lacks an awareness of the barriers that women face in a male-dominated culture. For instance, being able to brag about your accomplishments. So you actually have to address women, some of the women's training, in a little bit different way, much as you would have to address racism in a really different way for some of your students versus some other of your students.
Anyone out there that have questions, or do they have women in their program? Do you find that ex-offender women have special needs versus, say, ex-offender men? Or
That's a good question. I think the women, we actually are fortunate here in Portland in that our women's correctional facility, for a bit, we had a program inside the women's prison that taught them how to build. So it was sort of a pre-apprenticeship inside the prison that exposed them to the opportunities in the construction trades and got them ready, basically, to come to our program. Our ex-offenders tend to do very, very well. They are motivated. They know what they want. They know what they don't want. I think the barrier, the additional barrier that they face, of course, is the discrimination of having a legal history. But we have done a pretty good job of navigating the system, and we know who works well with ex-offenders or people with legal history in any respect, and we know which ones are more challenging. So I think therein lies the challenge of developing really close relationships with your employers, your partners, and knowing where good avenues are, where they'll get a really fair chance to show what they got. And again, our program, the community here in Portland knows that our program is super tough. So if our women make it through the program, that's sort of a, we are endorsing them. You know, we have vetted them, they've been drug tested, they've demonstrated reliability. So whether or not they have a legal history, if they come through our program, they have our stamp of approval, our employers know that we have signed off on them. So it really helps sort of mitigate some of the questionable history that might raise eyebrows.
You're using a model that we found many of the successful grantees have migrated to. They start out with the construction trades, and then they take the cream of the crop, not only cream of the crop, but the most motivated that really want to go to an environmental, and then they go on beyond, in your case, the 7 weeks. That extends beyond the 7 weeks then, doesn't it,
correct,
to
your
environmental. But the neat thing about that is you get to look at them, and they get to look at you, and it's almost like a tryout program. There's other programs that have a different approach where they go right into the environmental program. They don't have that benefit of the 7 weeks that you have to evaluate those students. And it's a great approach.
It is. I appreciate that because it makes my job easy. So when I reach out to an employer and I say, I can absolutely put my name behind this student, it's a real benefit. The only problem with that is that it is tremendously hard on our students to go through an unpaid 7-week program and then an additional program on top of that. And it screens out some of the women that we really prefer to reach. You know, if I don't know that I could go 2 months or longer without being paid. So we sort of have it on our longer term plate to create a program that would reach women more successfully that don't have the privilege, and it is a privilege, to be able to go through an unpaid program. But as you mentioned, you know, having the 7 weeks of the students, I know them. I'm out in the field with them. I've seen them. I've seen them at their best. I've seen them at their worst. I can be completely honest with an employer about what I've seen, and they've grown to trust me, and I know what I have at the end of my program, which makes them super, super easy to employ.
You know, another thing that's interesting is in learning about your program, while you're strongly associated with pre-apprenticeship programs, really only, it sounds like about half actually go into real apprenticeship union-type programs, where a lot of them just go into the non-traditional jobs directly.
That's very much true. I think I have some statistics around here somewhere. Yes, we had approximately half of our graduates go into registered apprenticeship. So with registered apprenticeship, we're talking about carpenters, electricians, laborers, plumbers, tree trimmers, cement masons. They go into that job. But there are a number that they're not ready for apprenticeship. It's not their goal. It's not what resonates with them. These are in many cases, the students that are really, really hot to get into our environmental program. So many of those environmental tech jobs are not through registered apprenticeship. They are independent of apprenticeship, and that's what our students want. They want to get out there on the river. They want to do that emergency response stuff. So we support our women going into whatever trade works best for them. And if they want to go into apprenticeship, we'll help them in that direction. And if apprenticeship is not for them, we will help them find trade jobs outside of apprenticeship.
Awesome. Any questions anyone would like to ask?
Hello?
Amy?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Oh, hi. This is Janice Toaster from St. Nick's. This was a really excellent presentation. And, you know, one of the things that I'm taking away is, you know, when our program is doing outreach, I don't think even, you know, we you know, give the description about the program, we talk about the programs we offer. But, you know, I'm thinking now that I don't think that we emphasize enough that our programs are open to both men and women, because our programs are so heavily populated by men. So I think now after hearing this, I think we're going to be a whole lot more intentional when we do, you know, outreach presentations in emphasizing that we welcome women. And, you know, also to talk about some of the successful women that we've had come through our program. So I'm realizing that we probably haven't been doing such a great job at that.
Thank you so much for that comment. I really appreciate your understanding that reaching out to women is a very specific task. And if we can at any time support you in that or give you images of tradeswomen to add to your literature, please let me know. I'm happy to help.
Okay, I'm going to put Amy's contact information in there so you can contact her direct.
Okay, great. Yes, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, great. This is Dana in Memphis. And I want to, I'm with Janet. I was just jumping in my chair here, just hearing about your program. I think it's amazing, and I'm excited to hear that how successful you've been. And so here we're in our recruitment process, and we've had quite a few women attend our information sessions, and they're interested in the environmental jobs. And I guess the thought came to me is And I know it's just maybe a natural reflection of how can I sell, you know, these women to employers. And I just kind of want to ask you the question when you were, I guess, developing your program or meeting with your employers, or, you know, did you find any challenges with, I guess, advocating for your women participants versus male? And if so, how did you overcome that? Or what was maybe some approaches you have?
Yeah. Again, very, very good question, and very much a reality of sort of reminding employers that women make really, really good environmental tech.
Right.
So I think we've had the fortune of being around since 1989, so we have a really strong reputation in the community, and I think that I've had the luxury of sort of drafting off of that success. So when women
okay.
come out of our program,
okay.
employers already know that they're going to be good workers. There's already
okay.
enough of our women out in the community doing the work that they gossip. You know, all these contractors gossip. Like, oh, you know, Oregon Tradeswomen is a great place to get really skilled, qualified, pre-screened, you know, drug-tested workers. But with smaller employers, because I'm now reaching out to just small residential contractors as a source for good workers, I'm very much confronted with this. They're like, what, women? What? Are they going to break
mm-hmm.
a nail? You know,
mm-hmm.
they go through this whole thing about
right.
these cultural assumptions, and it's just if you're confident in your students or your graduates' skill level, they're going to be
okay.
confident. So I think it's just developing your own confidence in the program and having successful workers come out of it that you're able to speak with complete confidence to your employer. Say, yeah, we have this woman, and her attention to detail is off the charts. And she's a strong worker. You know, she's got a military background. She knows what it's like to get down and dirty. And sometimes you have to spell that out for employers. You know, you don't have to say that for the men. It's like you don't have to say, oh, they like to get down and dirty. You don't have to say that. But for the women, you have to remind these employers that these women know what it's like to be down in the trenches. They do the hard work. They know that they do the heavy lifting. And you actually have to spell it out for the employer so that they can do that. And I would also advise your students, your graduates, when they go for a job interview, to dress like a worker. So part of what they need to overcome is this preconceived notion of what women can and cannot do. And if they go in with any sort of feminine stuff, I mean, they can save that for the club, you know, but they have to take their earrings off and pull their hair back. And we actually ask our women to wear work clothes, not dirty work clothes, but it helps the employer, the potential employer, picture them doing the work if they show up to their job interview in boots and Carhartt, as if they could step out of this job interview and go right out and dig in a ditch. So there's just sort of those small things that help force an employer to picture the woman doing the work. And part of that's on you to say, hey, you know, when I saw her out in the field, you know, she put on that hazmat equipment and she was down under that thing crawling on her belly, I knew that she was going to be a good worker. And then that forces them to picture her doing the work. And if she's in a job interview and she tells a story about her being up on a ladder doing this thing, again, it forces them to picture her doing that work. And that really sort of helps put the employer's mind at ease that they're not getting some prima donna in there.
Gotcha. Gotcha. That's awesome. Thank you. That was
great.
Thank you.
If you're lucky, you might have a woman-owned business. There are surprisingly a large number of women construction, women-owned, minority women-owned businesses. And, of course, that's one place to start off in terms of that placement process. One of the things I get from AD – oh, go ahead. Someone
– oh, hi. This is Houston, Houston McHale, the president of North Omaha Contractors Alliance out here in Omaha, Nebraska. And with our women, basically, we deal with a lot of ex-offender women that's getting out of prison, and then they still on paperwork and parole and things like that. And then we have some women who are trying to get out of trouble due to, like, whether DUIs or some other crime they committed. So basically, we teamed up with what we call Nebraska Department Development Center out here, NBDC. And to our amaze, most of these ladies are getting their own company started with women-owned companies in this construction that we train in. You know, and out here in Omaha, the EPA is a big field. Like, just recently, we certified over, like, 85 people in order to want to work on a program called Re-Energize Omaha. And that worked so well, but then the monies ran out. And so now these people are back stuck with nothing to do. But we noticed that our women that come through the program, they end up getting swooped away and end up starting their own construction business because out here is so much help for women minority-owned businesses. And it's outrageous. It's wonderful for them.
That's an amazing story. I mean, that's a testament to your program, though. If they go out of your program with enough confidence, feeling like they can start their own company, you've done a great job.
Like, wait a minute. You can't keep taking all the women from us, you know. But out here, though, we have an agency. It's PTAC, and they're getting them registered in the SAMS, the ORCA, the Hub Zone. They're getting registered. They're getting certified. And they also, they out there subcontracting a lot of work that they particularly don't do. And it's working well for, like, two of our little ladies.
Well, that's a very ingenuitive response to a culture that may not accept them as a worker. They're like, well, screw it. Then I'm going to go out and start my own company. I think that's brilliant.
Okay, yep. So I just wanted to add that in. I'm going to shut up now.
Good point.
You know, one theme that I see that Amy has emphasized, and you could correct me, Amy, is you really need to get women out front, whether it's recruitment or particularly placement. If you have special women who really are outstanding, you need to get them out there as mentors. You need to get them out there in recruitment as role models. You need to get them out in front of employers. That's and if you have a mixed program, you might have those people, but they're male, not female.
Yeah, and if you make that a part of your training culture, you know, if you start to, it's sort of feng shui in a way that if you make the room for women, the women are going to come. If you start using gender-neutral language, like don't refer to your students as all guys, because that doesn't resonate with a woman. You have women trainers, or have some of your successful female students come back and help you with outreach in your posters and have them be on the radio or on TV. That will stick with a woman. So if it's a dude talking about the program, and it will definitely resonate with other men out there. But if you specifically have a woman, her ears are going to perk up if she hears on the radio, or her ears are going to perk up, or her eyes when she sees an image of another woman doing this work, talking about how she got out of poverty, that she's feeding her kids now, that she's making, you know, $25 an hour. That will, a woman will listen to that, and she will call your program, and you just need to be ready for her. You need to be ready to support her, ready to open, you know, open arms, and you can absolutely do this, and we will train you, and it'll happen.
This has been a great session. You know, it'd be a great session to have at our annual grantee meeting, because every one of our grantees, to some extent, are dealing with a gender-neutral program one way or another, and they need to know these tips that you've got that are really good, and maybe we think about them intuitively, but we don't implement them. And this has been a great session, Amy. I really appreciate
the opportunity, and I would be happy. I do have this conversation every year that I've attended. I have this conversation in the hallway a bunch of times, so maybe it is time to do. I'd be happy to present to a larger group if you feel that would be useful to the grantees.
It would be great.
It would be
great. If no other questions, we try to keep these to the half hour, but this has just been so great. I really thank you for your time, and best of all wishes from us. And
thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
We're going to have our 10th of 10 in this cycle on the 15th of April, so we could also carry this conversation over. And we're going to do on the 15th kind of a wrap-up of the entire cycle, some of the issues we talked about, including women in the programs, and including first-year startup and some of the success stories. So wait for the post-session notes. We'll try to capture as much of this as we can. We'll put Amy's contact information in so you could contact her directly, and we'll have all the meeting information. So everyone have a great week, and a happy Easter.
Thanks so much.
We'll
thank you.
Talk to you all soon.
Thank you.
Happy Easter to you guys, too. Bye-bye.
Yes. Thank you.
Oh, that's what it